Welcome for this argument, Lancaster High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The high school students are here with our national award-winning program titled Court with Class. It's sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. And what we do is send the briefs of the case that the students will hear to the students, and they may engage in outside activities relating to the matters. And then they appear at oral argument. Usually, if they appear in the morning, we have a justice meet with them to discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues that are involved. So welcome to you all. If anyone would like a summary of the case we're about to hear, raise your hand and we will give it to you. It's better to know a little bit about the case than not know anything. Does anyone need a summary of this case? All right, let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right is Justice David Prosser. And on the far right is Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I will call our third case for today, 06AP0364, Shannon Nichols versus Progressive Northern Insurance Company, arguing on behalf of Edwin Neeson. The defendant is Arnold P. Anderson. Counsel, you may proceed.
Chief Justice Abrahamson, members of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, thank you and good afternoon. I represent Berry and Roxbury Insurance Company, the insurer for the Neesons, our insureds, and I'll be having the argument. We've filed joint briefs, and for purposes of this appeal, our interests are identical. This case is before the Wisconsin Supreme Court on a motion to dismiss a complaint. And I'd like to go back very briefly and outline the history of how we got here. The first complaint that was filed was a complaint that only alleged a violation of Section 125.07, Parent 1, Parent, Parent A, Parent 3, and that's a statute that deals with places that have permits or licenses to sell liquor. That was alleged in this complaint, even though the Neesons have nothing to do with having a license for liquor. When that complaint was filed, we responded immediately with a motion to dismiss that statute didn't apply. Plaintiffs requested time to file an amended complaint, which they did. They amended the complaint and they added additional cause of action, and that one was for common law negligence, and that's what brings us before the court today. The trial court held that statutory violation under 125.07 did not apply. The Court of Appeals affirmed because the Neesons don't run a premises, and therefore the statute does not apply. I mention that because the statutory language that's used in that paragraph, which is now out of the case, there's no appeal from that statute. I mention because we see some of that language in that paragraph dealing with the statute floating over into the common law allegations. And indeed, the Court of Appeals at one point is citing language out of that statute. Our position is that when the court found that statute didn't apply, that paragraph is dead, particularly from the standpoint of the fact that the paragraph itself parrots the statute. It's almost word for word. And we believe that with that statute being held not applicable, and that statute and that allegation not being before the court, we are now before the court on an extremely limited area. And that extremely limited area is that the Neesons knew that there was some underage drinking going on in their property. I think it's also important to point out what is not alleged. What is not alleged in this case is a violation of Section 125.035. That section provides that if any individual procures or provides alcoholic beverages to minors, that they are liable under that statute. This court has gone fairly far in interpreting those terms, procure and provide, broadly. Such terms such as broadly prescribe, cause to happen, to bring about. Therefore, what we do not have here is a claim that involved parents who caused to bring about alcoholic beverages being drunk on their property. This is not the case where you've got parents that say, heck, our kids are going to drink anyway, I'm going to make sure they drink at home, they can come over here and drink. That's not this case. That's for another day, and maybe someone arguing under 125.035 that there's a viable claim against parents that do that. Instead, this case is before the court simply on the allegation that on information and belief, Neesons were aware that there was some drinking going on in their property. And we don't think that that's the law in this state. What the plaintiffs want to do is move common law out to where it's never gone before. I don't know of any case anywhere that holds liability for someone simply because they know something. If you examine the cases dealing with providing alcohol, if you deal with the cases dealing with parents, there is some activity of some kind that they entered into, telling them they could show up. A couple of cases in other states where the parents had said, yeah, we'll take care of it, we'll watch, we'll make sure they have the keys, where they assumed an obligation.
Well, counsel, what about 125.071A4? And that's the provision that's cited, I think, in the amicus brief. And that says no person no adult may intentionally encourage or contribute to a violation of 4A or B. And 4A or B is underaged people procuring alcohol or attempting to procure or consuming alcohol on licensed premises or falsely represented, or will be any underage person not accompanied who has attained and hasn't attained the legal drinking age, knowingly possesses or consumes alcohol beverage. So if you have an underage person with alcohol beverages, that is a violation of 127.074B. I mean, this is the argument. And then 127.07 says that no adult may encourage or contribute to the violation of 4B.
What was that last statute, Chief Justice?
125.071A4. I mean, this is the argument in the amicus brief. I mean,
right.
No one answered the amicus brief, and as has happened in other cases, an amicus brief makes an argument that has not been fully developed by a party,
right.
And sometimes the parties will file a supplemental brief. Sometimes they'll argue it at oral argument. And I would like you to tell us whether this statute is applicable. Now, I know it's not referred to in the complaint. The Second Amendment complaint is in your brief. But they did allege that the Neesons knowingly permitted and failed to take action to prevent the illegal consumption of alcohol beverages. Now, they cite 125.071A3, but why doesn't that allegation fall within 125.071A4? They don't have to, I mean, this is notice pleading. They don't have to cite any statute, right?
They don't have to cite any statute?
Yeah.
You mean the amicus or anybody?
I mean, the complaint.
Well, I think even with notice pleading, defendants are entitled to some idea where we're going.
Yeah. I agree with that.
And there's the argument about 125.07 that was raised as far as not being a premises. I know we've argued about 125.07 not applying to civil liability for no other reason. All the civil liabilities dealing with alcohol are mentioned in Section 125.035. There's no provision for any civil liability, as I recall. I haven't looked at it lately. But there's no room for any civil liability under 125.07. And the argument is if the legislature had wanted civil liability as opposed to forfeiture, they would have said so in 125.07, and they did not. That's the best I can do.
Yeah, well, usually if there's a statute, then the issue is whether or not that statute, which if it doesn't express the to civil liability impliedly does, and there's a whole body of law on that, right?
Right, which we have not gotten into.
That's right. That's what I'm raising this now, because there's a whole body of law on the issue of whether the statute is silent, can't you use the statute anyway as a basis for civil liability.
Theoretically, I can't tell any more than I have right now, other than with the posture that this case came before the Supreme Court, before this court, I was no longer looking at 125.07 because that had been taken off the board. The amicus brief talks about that statute, but only as general rationale, somehow supporting the common law cause of action, as I remember the argument. And it was rationale in there that they wanted to transfer over to common law. And they're looking at that statute not as a violation of the statute, but some indication what the legislature was thinking when they passed that statute. And that thinking is identical to the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers saying, you know, we ought to expand liability to anybody that knows that there's some drinking going on at their premises.
That's on page 11 of their brief. Yeah, that's pretty good. Okay.
Mr. Anderson, let me ask you a question going back to the common law negligence claim. I've been thinking about the fact that we approach it in Wisconsin in terms of usually talking about duty, breach, and damages.
Yes.
And we've got a number of cases that talk about the fact that there's a duty of due care that is owed to everyone. Why isn't that line of cases and that line of thinking applicable here?
Well, we think it is. And we put that in our brief, and it comes in the terms of foreseeability. As I understand it, the first item you look at for liability is that foreseeability. In other words, would a reasonable person in the position of the defendant have foreseen some injury or harm to somebody? You get into the thing about whether it's an individual or not, but it's generally any person, and we've made that argument.
Well, but here you've told us this comes before us on a motion to dismiss.
Yes.
And my understanding is that on a motion to dismiss, we basically take the allegations as true. So how does the foreseeability issue get into it at this stage? This isn't a summary judgment motion, but a motion to dismiss.
Because you can take, I look at it, Justice, as on the standpoint of the role of a court as a gatekeeper. And it's probably best illustrated at the trial court. You can have someone who says that they're negligent, notice pleading, they knew or should have known, but if those facts are such that no reasonable person would have foreseen injury or harm, or if that injury or harm is so distant or disconnected, as I understand it, the courts in the state still have that gatekeeper role so that you don't automatically give every question to a jury.
But isn't that gatekeeper role, and I think of cases written by Justice Wilcox, one comes to mind, Rockwhite, another one, Gritzner, where the gatekeeping role really is in the public policy application. That is, there are, I think, I don't have them in front of me, let's say five or six rather traditional public policy considerations, and one is there's no stopping point. So assuming negligence, assuming there is a cause of action in negligence, we're nevertheless going to perform a gatekeeping function vis-a-vis the public policy determinations. And so isn't that where it comes in under Rock, Wright, and Gritzner? I can pull those cases.
But I think and particularly when I read, I believe, Hoyta, the last case that talks about it.
Yeah, well, that's different than Rock. I'm talking about Rock,
I
Wright,
know.
And Gritzner.
Right. I know you are.
And you and I both know what we're talking about.
And Justice Bradley, I think it's probably in both. Because I think you have what you have, as I understand it, in that foreseeability question, you know, the very first question as to whether or not it's foreseeable from the standpoint of an individual, the word duty has been attached to that. And I don't know that that's a bad thing, but then you still have what I could call a gatekeeper role also, but it's over into the public policy area.
Let's take a special verdict, right? What's the question? Were they negligent? You know, was it causal? You know, were there damages? And so here I am, and I see these Lancaster students here. You know, this would never happen at their house. But having been the mother of some teenagers, I say to myself, whoa. And that's spelled W-O-O-O-H. I say, look, if I'm a parent and I have, and if I know there are kids coming over downstairs in the rec room and maybe they're bringing their own alcohol, and then I know they're going to be there until midnight or 1 o'clock, and then I know they're going home or driving someplace, I think there's room to say, if I know all that stuff, that I'm not exercising ordinary care in allowing even though I didn't provide alcohol, the drinking and the driving. Now, I'm not sure there's causation, I'm not sure there's damages, but I think whether or not I'm exercising ordinary care as a parent, the queen of my kingdom, what's your response to that?
I was looking. Did you say these parents knew the kids were coming?
Parents knew that there were kids that, or had reason to know, that would likely be drinking and driving. How's that in my fact situation?
Then you'd have a different case than what we have before the court.
But isn't the allegations in the complaint that the parents, on information and belief, that the parents were aware that the minors around their property were consuming alcohol in paragraph 16 of the second amended complaint?
Yes.
And this is a motion to dismiss?
Yes.
Why isn't that good enough?
Because there's still in that allegation no action in terms of the parents expecting it, knowing it would happen, inviting it, if you will, telling them, you know, the kids had been over there before, you can always drink at the Neeson's. None of that's here. The only thing we have is a simple knowledge that they knew there was some drinking going on without any of the relationship, if you will, items going into what you described, that is a relationship with the children that is such you know about your kids, a relationship with the others, you know who they are, the relationship so you know they're going to be bringing alcohol over.
I don't know what the facts are, But I know what the allegations and the complaint are. And the allegation is that they were aware that minors around their property were consuming alcohol. They failed to take reasonable steps to supervise and monitor the activities on their property. Seems like that, and I'm not sure they can get even close to home on home plate on this kind of a case. But it seems to me that there's enough there to aver ordinary negligence, no?
I'm afraid that foreseeability is one of those things that may be more in the eye of the beholder than an objective standard, and it varies from case to case. All I can say is that we submit that it is not foreseeable with simply knowledge, and that when you get into the items that we would normally think about, that parents that know where the kids are, know who their friends are, know who's coming over, know they've been drinking before, you slide over then to an area that we submit is already probably covered under the statute and procure and cause to happen. As I've indicated, this is a narrow, narrow area we're talking about here. And the way this complaint is alleged, it's knowledge alone that does it. There's no allegation of any in loco parentis.
Failing to supervise isn't sufficient here? I mean, isn't this a negligent supervision
themselves,
case?
It's not alleged, at least, insofar as that they've put themselves in a position that they were now are the parents in loco parentis with these children. Unlike Stevenson, there is no conduct, there is no agreement that we're going to take over, we're going to run this.
One final question, if I may, and that is, by our earlier exchange, is it your position that the rationale articulated in Rockwhite and Ritzner no longer is applicable to cases of this type?
I think you have to read those cases very carefully in terms of the delineation between foreseeability as it pertains to establishing the four criteria for liability.
Okay, but the question is, I know that Gritzner and Rockwhite didn't focus on foreseeability. That wasn't the framework of their analysis. Rather, it was the Paul's graph dissent. My question is whether or not the framework of analysis set forth in Rockwhite and Gritzner is any longer applicable in this thing to a common law negligence cause of action.
Not after what I read in Hoyda.
Yeah, that's what I was concerned about. We're now on the majority of Paul's
May I ask? May I ask, Mr. Anderson? As a general rule, negligence applies to everyone. The
yes.
Law of negligence. Now, there are people who are immune from negligence. In this case, have provisions of Chapter 125 displaced negligence law, or is it still there?
Thank you, Justice Prosser. I think this court has indicated pretty clearly that what happened when the legislature acted in enacting 125.035, they were codifying common law. Now you have beyond that the next question, that is, if indeed the legislature codified common law so that there's immunity for everybody except those who provide or procure or serve to underage drinkers, then do you go any further than that? And this court has indicated that if you're going to go beyond that area that has now been codified by the legislature, at least in Stevenson, this court indicated that is really something for the legislature to look at. And I can't emphasize too much how quickly we get into issues that are way beyond this case in terms of how is the legislature going to strike a balance between, for example, the rights of parents, there's nothing about parents in this case, the rights of underage people, the rights of society with regard to drinking and drinking on the highways. Waddell tells us that this is an important case dealing with underage drinkers and the problem of underage drinkers. I respond, if the Academy and others are really concerned about underage alcohol, maybe it's time to take a look and see if there should be different rules for those under 18. Parents have responsibility for their children under 18 for education, for health care, for truancy, and the rest of it. I just wonder what an impact would have if in this state, if any youngster were caught having alcohol, any alcohol at all, and their license was pulled until 21, My guess is that's going to do a lot more good than anything you do in this court as far as stopping the mayhem on the highway. If you go one step further, as you have for liability laws in this state, so that you have to sign if your child is under 18 and you're liable, I wonder what happens in this state if for alcoholic beverages, anybody's picked up alcoholic beverages and that parent loses their license for 6 months. There you might get some real reaction and you get a hold of the problem. I think what we've got here is a very interesting legal issue, but in terms of coming to grips with alcohol and the use of alcohol by minors, and this whole thing you get into about should parents encourage it at home, but that's really encouraging breaking the law, and you don't want to do that. And we say that, and we're 90 miles away from Miller Park, good grief, you know, named after a beer. You get all kinds of issues, but they're not here. Thank you.
So is your position that 125.035 gives immunity even though subsection 2 deals with procuring?
In this case?
Yeah.
We have minors here, don't we?
I know. But in what?
My position is that that statute was not alleged. And then, therefore, I've been looking at this case entirely from the standpoint that we're off the statutes, we're on to common law.
And common law?
Dealing with minors. And into now the question whether or not this court wants to extend common law out. And so it's something more than what you have in 125. Liability that would arise for providing minors under 125.035. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Knutson?
Good afternoon. May it please the court. The Nichols family who are here today, I know they would want me to thank all their friends and family who came to support them today. I'm Jason Knutson, and I represent Shannon, Lee, Brooke, and Brittany. As you can see, I've got stacks of papers here that I've read through. I had all these pithy legal arguments that I was ready to deliver. But, of course, I end up going back to the simplest argument that I'd thought of over the past several weeks, which is my own foreseeability test in this case, which I call my oh no test, or for people from Minnesota, my oh cripes test, which is when you tell anyone about the facts of this case, and I realize they're limited, when you start that story halfway through, any reasonable person says, oh no, waiting to hear the second half of the story. Anyone who hears adults permitted minors to have an underage drinking party on their property invariably says, oh no, because we all know, and any reasonable person knows, that an underage drinking party invariably ends badly. It either ends with drunk driving, it ends with an assault, a sexual assault, or most recently with 50-some people holed up in a shed in Wanakee. Never do we hear about the underage drinking party ending great. Everyone had a great time, got home safe, no problems. Of course it's foreseeable that permitting minors to drink on your property is going to lead to something regrettable. Negligence is in this case, which takes us to public policy. And this is even more troubling to me. The public policy in our state is crystal clear. We want to prevent drunk driving. We want to keep alcohol out of the hands of minors. And for minors to drink, we have two essential conditions precedent. One, they have to illegally procure alcohol. Two, they have to have a place to drink it. And not just any place, but a safe place. And by safe, I mean a place where they know they can get away with it, or they at least have a chance to. The Neesons provided that essential second precedent so that the minors here could consume alcohol. To say that our public policy, which is clearly stated to prevent drunk driving and prevent minors from getting alcohol, to say that that public policy should shield that conduct, immunize them as a matter of law for that behavior, I think turns public policy on its head, especially in light of the oh no foreseeability analysis.
Counselor, as part of your ONO foreseeability analysis, do you assume that the owners of the property had an obligation to supervise or to monitor these kids?
Not necessarily. And I simplify it back to ordinary care. Is it foreseeable that you're creating some unreasonable risk of harm to someone? I think that Attorney Anderson in his brief has pointed out the list of horribles that we can all think of when we've got unruly minors on our property. Are we going to take away the keys? Are we going to make them spend the night? Are we going to call cabs? We don't have to get that far. Don't permit the minors to have the underage drinking party on your property in the first place. When viewed through that lens, all these concerns vanish. We don't have to worry about the unreasonable burden. Is that really such a burden?
Counsel, can you direct me to the area where you allege your negligence claim? Isn't it paragraph 16 of the complaint?
At paragraphs 15, 16, and 17, Justice Siegler.
Okay. And that's the failure to take reasonable steps to supervise and monitor.
Paragraph 15 sets out that the Neesons knowingly permitted the consumption of alcohol.
15 is the 125 statutory claim, isn't it?
Well, the statute is mentioned at the end of that paragraph, Justice. I would argue that the pleadings are to be construed liberally to do substantial justice and that we shouldn't be hemmed in necessarily by the borders of the statute. I think the elements of the negligence claim are apparent in 15, 16, and 17 in that complaint.
Okay, so you intended to bring two causes of action, but they're all stated in 15, 16, and 17 instead of specifically set forth like first cause of action, second cause of action.
I think that's a fair reading, Justice.
Okay, so when the judge dismissed the 125 cause of action, that wasn't eliminating paragraph 15?
That's right.
Okay.
Getting back to the other public policy factors then, that have been raised in this case. My mentor, Mike Riley, told me yesterday that the genius of the law is in drawing lines and distinctions. And Justice Bradley, in the example that you gave of the parent, and I think any parent can relate to the example you gave, the kids are coming over, they're going to have a couple beers in the basement. What happens? I think it's interesting that in that example, at least the parents retained some degree of supervision. And that's a handful of kids in the basement. Unlike here, where we know we have a grouping of dozens of minors, unsupervised, where I think the risk of harm is even greater. And so the public policy factors that are listed, I think, indicate very strongly that this is not the type of conduct that we want to provide blanket immunity for.
Well, counsel, let me ask this, because I'm looking at the three paragraphs that you've outlined in the complaint, and I think I understand where your argument is going if you read paragraph 15 with 16. But if you look at paragraph 16 in and of itself as setting forth some duty to supervise, and I'll use Justice Bradley's example, having had teenagers, does that mean that every parent, if this is the basis of the complaint, every parent, every time teenagers come over to the house, has a duty to go down and sit in with the teenagers to make sure that they're not bringing alcohol? Because you can't assume that children are going to bring alcohol. You can't assume that they're going to be sitting down there drinking. I mean, it's one thing to allege that they knowingly allowed it to happen. It's another thing to say that there's a duty to keep it from happening in the first instance. So do you need 15 with 16 to state a cause of action, or do you think 16 stands on its own?
No, I think you make a good point. And I don't believe that a parent has a duty to run downstairs every time children get together. Coming from a parent whose son's nickname is Godzilla, trust me, I've considered these scenarios carefully. And I think the beauty of the law we have here is that we can fall back to ordinary care. Just go back to ordinary care. If your child or your son has a couple people come over, they go down the basement, you don't know if they're playing video games or what they're doing. Is it ordinary care for you to just let that go? I think it is. I think a reasonable person says, no, I don't have to check in on my child every 5 minutes to see what they're up to. We're allowed to give them some leash. But as we've learned, too much leash can sometimes be a bad thing, especially when we create an environment that we know is conducive to something bad happening.
Therefore, the key to this complaint is paragraph 15 and the words knowingly permitted.
I believe those are key words, Justice. Yes. Yes. No one here is looking to impose some broadened negligence standard on anyone. I know that this case has been attempted to be cast in that light. We aren't arguing that the negligence standard needs to be broadened at all. We just want the Neesons held to the same ordinary care standard that we're all held to, and with an additional backstop of our comparative negligence law. So we aren't even arguing that they're going to be held negligent per se or strictly liable. They'll still have the additional benefit of having their culpability measured against the other players in this disaster.
Now, let me ask one other question related to paragraph 15, because when I read the phrase knowingly permitted, I think one can argue that that's states facts, another could argue that that's really a conclusion. And so my question goes to whether or not there are any facts in the complaint to support the conclusion of knowledge here, or if this is pretty much where it is.
I believe one key to analyzing the complaint is going to be giving us the reasonable inferences that we're entitled to on a review of a motion to dismiss. And I think a reasonable inference from the fact that this party occurred and there was such a congregation of minors is that there was some knowledge that this behavior was going to be permitted. If the minors knew it wasn't going to be okay, they wouldn't have been congregating on this property.
But the knowledge in question has to be the knowledge of the parents.
Right.
Well, I don't know that one, you can leap to that conclusion that the parents would know that the children are coming over to drink. And that's why I asked the question, is there anything in the facts of this complaint to indicate the knowledge aspect of the parents versus the conclusion that they must have known?
Right. I think I understand your question. And I don't think you're going to find a specific fact that's spot on, like you're looking for. I think we have to take the complaint as true, and we have to draw the reasonable inferences from it. Any other questions, Justices? Then before I sit down, I'd just like to reiterate. I believe that the complaint in this case has stated our claim for negligence. I'm sure you will come up with a more artful way to describe the oh no foreseeability test. But I think whatever takes us back to that ordinary care standard is where we need to be. The negligence law in the state of Wisconsin makes sense. We're not asking.
I'm going to interrupt you in your closing. I'm sorry. But this oh no foreseeability, I say with some judicial restraint, causes me to pause. I'm looking at a law review article on foreseeability. And one of the points made in this law review article is the difference of the concept of foreseeability between the Cardozo's opinion in the majority in Paul's graph and Justice Andrews' dissent and how foreseeability is treated differently. And can you venture a comment, and you don't have to if you don't feel comfortable doing it, where your oh no foreseeability falls in? It seems to me this. It seems to me that you're falling into the argument of the plaintiff, of the defense, that the defense is arguing foreseeability vis-a-vis duty, which is right out of the Paul's graph majority, and as the defense counsel says, is hoida. And it seems to me you should be arguing something different, but you're arguing the oh no foreseeability right in lockstep with defense counsel. Do you have any response to that? I might not be making sense, and that can be the response as though you say it, but you have to say it delicately.
Right. I'm sure you're making perfect sense, Justice Bradley. Let me respond this way. I believe in the foundational principles of the negligence law in Wisconsin, and I believe that we do have the duty that you described earlier when Attorney Anderson was speaking. The duty of ordinary care to everyone at all times in the same or similar circumstances. Mm-hmm. And I believe that our foreseeability flows from that judicial use of ordinary care. Getting into Paul's graph and then Hoyda and how those may interplay here. I don't think we'll necessarily change the analysis here because, happily but unfortunately, the facts of this situation are such that it's difficult for any reasonable person to deny that an underage drinking party is going to lead to some unreasonable risk of harm.
Could I ask, the driver was underage, is that right, that caused the accident?
Yes.
What if all the facts were the same, except that the driver was an adult who happened to be in that group?
Meaning, would the landowner still bear some responsibility for hosting the event? I think that when the status of the players in the negligence analysis changes, that the entire analysis would have to change. I think the fact that we're dealing with minors here really is a key, and it goes back to what I said earlier about the genius of the law being in its line drawing and its distinction drawing. We've chosen, as members of the community, to draw that bright line when it comes to minors. And so I think the analysis would change if we were dealing with adults, which I think goes to what Attorney Anderson has argued about this sort of larger social host implications, which this case isn't. This isn't about adults hosting other adults. It's about adults permitting minors to drink to excess.
It seems to me, though, when somebody is procuring or providing alcohol to a minor, don't they generally know it is a minor? I mean, isn't there some sort of mens rea there? I'm having a little trouble distinguishing when you don't know who might cause an accident at a party.
And I would submit that that takes us back to the very fact-driven nature of negligence claims like this, which is an additional safety to some of the public policy factors that have been argued. Whether or not it's ordinary care to be providing or procuring alcohol for someone who you don't know is a minor is certainly a different question than what is alleged here, where we know that it was a minor, and especially for purposes of the motion to dismiss can be assumed to be true.
This is a very troublesome case. I mean, it's a heart-wrenching case. How would you deal with the concern that if you were to win, where does this stop?
Well, I believe, again, the first clear bright line is minors. We are not implicating adult social hosts. And I think the Court of Appeals got it right in their conclusion when they said, thus, we do not conclude, as a matter of public policy, that allowing underage high school students to become intoxicated on one's property is conduct shielded from liability by public policy considerations. I think already we've got the framework there hemming in this type of case so that we can avoid the slippery slope and the fraud alarm that gets sounded by the defense in this case.
So, counsel, you would say it would only apply in instances where there's actual knowledge. It wouldn't be the typical knew or should have known standard.
Well, that's a good question, Justice. And I think, again, these cases are going to be so largely fact-driven by what knowledge there is and when they acquired it and what it is knowledge of exactly. In this case, that analysis is a little bit easier because we're on the motion to dismiss and we can assume that they knew that these minors were drinking alcohol on their property. When we come to questions of the should have known, the comparative negligence analysis will probably change somewhat.
What concerns me, as I read the Court of Appeals, both the majority opinion and the dissent, and as I read your brief, is this. I may be overstating my concern, but my understanding is that at common law, the general rule was the person who gave the individual alcoholic beverages was not liable for damages resulting from that intoxicated person. The theory was that the intoxicated person deliberately consumed the beverage, and they were liable. You might put it in negligence terms, in terms of the intoxicated person was an independent intervening cause. And then, and it seemed to me that was the law as to minors too, even though there's regulation about serving minors, and that the court divided for many years regarding the liability of someone who served or procured a minor, alcoholic beverages for a minor. And then you get to the cases that our court decided that said, no, we're going to look at this as negligence. And they're described in the Court of Appeals, and that's the Seibel case, Garcia v. Hargrove, and then Olson. And then they all were against the plaintiffs. And then the common law precluding liability for suppliers was abrogated in 84. That was Sorensen, and that was a minor. And then you got other Kobach, which was a social host serving to a minor. And this case, so you have this court extending common law, which is the way common law develops and is traditional and well accepted. And then the issue is whether the common law should be extended to a person who knows and permits the drinking of alcohol on the premises. But your brief says the Court of Appeals did not extend liability in its decision, page 10. Simply refused to allow the defendants a heretofore unrecognized mutation of Wisconsin law, namely immunity. Defenses failed to provide any reason why a negligence analysis should not apply. But traditionally, we've said negligence analysis doesn't apply in these liquor cases, and that these have been extended and sliced and diced thereafter. So I don't know how you can say the Court of Appeals did not extend liability in its decision.
I think I can get away with that, Justice, and you'll be the ultimate judge of whether I can, because all they've done is apply ordinary care.
That's right.
Right.
But generally, ordinary negligence has not been applied in these liquor to minor cases.
Right. I understand that. And I agree that there are cases that go both ways. And that's why we wholeheartedly welcome the public policy analysis to try and make sense of the common law. And I think, again, and I've stated this before, I think the public policy of this state clearly indicates that this is not the type of behavior that we want to condone, let alone immunize from liability.
I'm going to re-ask a question that was asked earlier, maybe in a different framework by another justice. You mentioned public policy. We use that phrase in different ways, public policy being what's good public policy for the state. We also use the phrase in terms of public policy limitations, and I was referring to that in my questions to your opposing counsel. Also, one public policy consideration is no just stopping point. Justice Prosser referred to that. And that's an area of concern for me in this case. It sounds easy to draw the line 18. You're under 18, you're a minor. How does that unfold when you have kids that are 18 and a half and 17 and a half, or 18 and still in high school, and And why should it make a difference? Why should it make a difference if I am, you know, 21, of course, is the age, but if I'm serving alcohol to, if I know alcohol, give the facts of this case, if I know alcohol is there, it's all 22-year-olds, but they're drinking heavy liquor, as opposed to underage that there might be a couple of beers. I mean, how do you get into this? How do you define and draw those lines? Where is the stopping point? I'm not so sure it's so easy to draw that kind of a line.
Oh, and I'm sure it's not. And happily, I just pass through these chambers while you go on to struggle with those issues long after I'm gone. But our legislature has decided that is where we want that stopping point. Is 21 versus 18 fair? Is 16 fair? Which age really makes sense? We've decided that if adults want to host adults and get drunk, well, this is Wisconsin, it's going to happen. But we've also decided that we do not want minors drinking alcohol, and we do not want anyone drinking and driving. And so with those indisputable overarching public policy concerns, I'm hopeful that the court will have some assurance that in drawing that line, it's endorsed, at least by the citizenry of Wisconsin. I didn't make you feel too much better, but I tried.
Well, here, I'll put on a smile. Then.
Okay.
Do you agree or disagree, then, that Chapter 125 codifies the common law?
No, I believe that Chief Justice Abrahamson's recitation of the history was absolutely correct, and that there were cases that have applied the negligence analysis to alcohol cases and others that didn't. And where we are now, again, is me trying to recenter it back on the ordinary care standard. I think that the negligence analysis can be applied to cases like this, which is why I don't believe that this is a drastic extension of common law liability.
Common law meaning the decisions of this court relating to alcohol and minors.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. Thank you, Justices.
One other question, I'm sorry. But
trying to escape.
Sure, I agree with paragraph 10 in the Court of Appeals. It says 125.071A3 states no person shall, no adult, that's the section you cited, may knowingly permit or fail to take action to prevent illegal consumption by underage person on premises owned by the adult or under the adult's control. And then they went to look at the definition of premises. And it limits premises to owned by that adult or under the adult's control. Would that be a bartender?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last.
Would that be a bartender?
Under one reading, I suppose that it could be.
I don't see how you can have licensed premises that aren't owned by an adult. I mean, I just don't understand that. I know that premises is defined, but it also says in the definition, except as otherwise provided. So every once in a while you find in statutes the legislature has not used a defined term properly. So I don't know why they would say premises owned by an adult or other under other control. I don't think you can have alcoholic beverage premises owned by anyone else by an adult. And I think anyone that serves there might very well be under the adult's control. Now I have to think through whether you'd have an adult companion to the minor who at a licensed premise gives alcoholic beverage, but that raises other issues, and you're not supposed to do that at a licensed establishment. But so I'm a little concerned about paragraph 10. Thank you. Unless there's another question. This time you might be excused.
Thank you, Justices.
Thank you. Counsel, Mr. Anderson.
Since this may be my last opportunity to have a case, I'm going to mention something personally. I had the good fortune of clerking for Justice Connor Hanson, who wrote the majority opinion in Garcia. I'm afraid my legal career will be a beginning with alcohol and ending with alcohol.
Maybe not. Maybe not, counsel.
I'm from Minnesota. We drink a little bit less over there than Wisconsin.
That's not what the statistics show. We refuse to recognize that in this case.
You got the Norwegian
statistics. You'll notice.
You have the Norwegian statistics that they keep it hidden, but they're drinking just as much.
Well said.
Chief Justice Abramson, you've mentioned 125.07. I just want to comment. I think there's another line of cases that look at that statute and whether or not it's negligence per se. And so we did. We didn't need to get into that.
Are they cited in the cases?
I think they were probably in the lower court, but maybe in the initial briefs. But beyond that, the briefs appear. Okay. We never got that far.
All right.
The other is that still that troubling question about paragraph 15, and I'll just be reiterating that I don't see how that statutory language can survive. The other thing that struck me in preparing for this is that, and I know Justice Bradley, you're talking about duty. What struck me is sometimes we get a fine line between foreseeability, and then when we get over to the public policy factors. For example, in Justice Abrahamson's dissent in Stevenson, talking about the injury being too remote from the negligence, Chief Justice, you were citing the fact that there was, in fact, a direct relationship and that they were closely related, and that this meant that the injury was not too remote. You have that same concept floating around, I think, in foreseeability, where you have discussions about the relationship of the parties. And was the relationship of the parties such that they had a duty or they assumed a duty to take, to put them in that foreseeability area we're talking about? In the end, I think that it's an interesting debate about majority Pell's graph, minority of Pell's graph. And is it injury to anybody? But I think in the end, this court has to apply those elements, the tried and true elements, in terms of foreseeability. And the only thing I would comment on again is that, at least from our standpoint, we would desire that the trial courts, in those appropriate cases, still have the ability to say, no, that part of the case is not going to go forward. For example, I had one about 6 months ago where the trial court ruled that one of the defendants, a mother who had left, question was a six-year-old, the mother had left, and coincidentally, to get more beer, and came back, and while the mother was gone, the youngster got on an ATV and starts driving this ATV around, and the question that the judge answered, is there other defendants? But the judge ruled as a matter of law that that mother was not there, she was gone. There's nothing foreseeable about that and took that out of the case. I think there are those cases that still come up, and I think we have to be careful so we don't tell trial judges, this is everything goes to public policy. I think you want that kind of gatekeeping. Finally, the factors, I won't go into any of the factors, I would just recommend to the court, just for general background, one that I found extremely interesting, coincidentally written by Judith McMullen, who's professor of law at Marquette, and the article is 10 Lewis and Clark Law Review at page 333. It's a comprehensive analysis of this whole social problem that we have of underage drinking. And she goes into some detail with statistics, most or all of that really doesn't apply in our case, but I think it gave me, at least, a better understanding of the multiplicity of problems that you have with these, with this issue that's before the court. Way back when, I had the good fortune to actually teach high school social studies classes, and I looked at this and I figured I could get 3 weeks worth of class material out of this. But, and I think all those issues are humming around this case. But yet, rock bottom, we're here on a motion to dismiss the complaint, and we don't think the complaint states a cause of action. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. And I want to thank both counsel, Mr. Anderson and Mr. Knutson, for arguing a case that brings back to the court many cases that we have discussed in terms of liability for alcohol, which is a major issue in Wisconsin and in the country. So thank you for pointing us in the right direction on this motion to dismiss. That ends the hearing on 068P0364, Shannon Nichols versus Progressive Northern Insurance Company. The court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45, when it will hear the other three cases in its November calendar. And the court will meet in conference, in closed conference at 3:10.